Committee will come to order. Judiciary Committee will come to order. It is 12:30 on Monday, March 12th, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Paskin is here. Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. We expect Senator Coghill along in a minute or two. But we only have an hour. We've got two bills we want to hear and get introduced in front of the committee. So we will get started. The first bill is Senate Bill 151. The bill sponsor is here, Senator Meyer. And I believe that the version we're going to work on is /OOscar. If we could have a motion to adopt that.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
That brings the CS before us. Unless there is objection, there is not. The CS is in front of us, and we could have the sponsor and his able staff come forward. Tell us about this bill that's got so many co-sponsors on it. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I appreciate you hearing this bill today. And congratulations, Grandpa Paskman.
We do have a new grandfather in the committee.
Yes. Congratulations. For the record, my name is Senator Kevin Meyer, and I represent South Anchorage. I'm here to introduce Senate Bill 151, which could include fetal alcohol spectrum disorders as a mitigating factor in sentencing. Currently, under state law, FASD is not explicitly included in the definition of mental illness or defect definitions that the state uses in applying mitigating factors, although some will argue that it is implied that it is included. So this will make it clear that it is included. And I want to caution people that we're not introducing this as a means to get out of jail free, so to speak. But the intent here is to allow for more appropriate sentencing of these people who suffer from this disability. The people who suffer from FASD, the spectrum, they need to get treatment so that we can reduce the amount of recidivism that we have in our correction system. And when Chief Justice Caprinetti addressed the state legislature, he emphasized flexibility in sentencing. And Mr. Chairman, I couldn't agree more. And I think this is a good example of where a judge needs the flexibility, because you're dealing with a spectrum. Some who have this disability, some will have it mild, some will have it more severe. And the judge is, I believe, in the best position to determine that and to determine how that affected their behavior. Senate Bill 151 would provide this flexibility. Using this mitigating factor is not mandatory. The judge can use it or not use it. Again, it's totally up to their discretion. And as you know, Mr. Chairman, Alaska has the highest rate of FASD in the United States. And according to the experts at the Alaska FASD Partnership, people who have been diagnosed with FASD are disproportionately represented within our correction system. My office has been working with FASD Partnership Group and the Department of Law on this CS in front of the committee. We think we've got it to a point here with this CS that most everybody can agree with. We have several experts here who will testify who know this area much better than I. But as I learn more about FASD, the more motivated I get, because this is a disability that's totally preventable. But unfortunately, the child who has this disability is going to have it for the rest of their life. And so not only does it adversely impact the person for all their life, but also society. And the fact that it is totally preventable motivates me to do two things. One is to try to educate people about this so that both women and men will avoid drinking while the woman is pregnant. And second, so that we can better understand the disability and try to help these folks that have nothing that they did to suffer from this disability. So in my opinion, whatever we can do to help them, we should. And I think this bill goes a long ways to doing that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
A good opening statement. Thank you, Senator Meyer. Any questions for the senator or his staff? We will get into more detailed questions, but maybe you know I have a copy of the bill in front of me on page 3, lines 12 through 17. There is a mitigator right now in the books that says that the defendant committed the offense while suffering from a mental disease or defect that was insufficient to constitute a complete defense but significantly affected the defendant's conduct. Is that, and you're modifying that in light of your new mitigator, has that sub 18 mitigator been used in FASD cases, and if so, why is it not working?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question, and I'm going to have my trusty staff answer because she's done a lot more research than I on this. But yes, that is part of the reason for bringing this bill forward, is that some judges will say that yes, it's included in Section 18, and others will say it's not implicitly defined, and so it's kind of nebulous. It's
inconsistent, yes. Results there.
Yes.
Ms. Marsegan, welcome.
For the record, my name is Christine Marsegan, staff to Senator Kevin Meyer, as the senator, through the chair, as the senator addressed that, yes, it hasn't been explicit in terms of what has been included under that particular section. However, we do have, I believe, Judge Michael Jeffries online, who could probably answer this question a lot more thoroughly. I would like, however, like to point out through the chair that one of the big differences in version X to version O is that in version X, there was laid out an entire definition of what impaired brain function was in relation to mental disease or defect, because FASD is an impaired brain function. However, it was in discussions with both the Department of Law and other FASD advocates, trying to change a definition, as you know, sometimes can end up changing definitions elsewhere, and sort of what we really wanted to do was to focus on FASD as being a mitigating factor in sentencing. And so that section has been removed, and that's why you have more of a addition of a definition at the end of version O.
Sure. And let me just ask a follow-up question, and that is who makes this diagnosis? Who's capable of making it, and who in the regular course of cases would be making this diagnosis? Either one. Ms. Marsegan?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, I think in the bill here, the last line 30 on page 3, we're saying that it needs to be a neuropsychological examination. And again, there's people here who understand this much better than I as to what that a neuropsychological examination is.
But it's going to be a doctor.
Yes.
Okay. It's not going to be a physician's assistant or a nurse or a local therapist. I mean, you're not going to bring in a note from some nice clinical social worker who may mean well and say this person has FASD, in my opinion. It's going to have to be a doctor making the diagnosis.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it definitely. I think it's going to be up to the person to prove that, yes, this person is suffering from FASD. What I'm not clear about is a neuropsychological exam, if that's a psychiatrist or if that's a medical doctor. But, again, there's people here who can clarify that.
We will ask. It's a great question. And we do have, just for the committee's information, we've got Annie Carpinetti here to testify and answer questions. Kate Burkhart from the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. We do have Judge Jeffrey from Barrow who's going to testify. We also have Vicki Tinker from the Kenai FASD to answer questions, Quinlan Steiner to answer questions, and a couple members of the community who simply want to testify about the bill as well. So perhaps we should turn to that public testimony. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And why don't we go ahead and start with Judge Jeffrey in Barrow, if you're there on the line, sir.
Yes, thank you so much for hearing this bill, and I just really appreciated the opening statements from Senator Meyer and the excellent questions, and they're really hitting at some of the really key issues. As far as, you know, whether or not the existing law would be sufficient in itself, I can only relate my personal experience with this, where back in 1990, I accepted what's called a non-statutory mitigating factor for a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder condition. And basically, my colleagues on the three-judge panel sent it back to me saying that the legislature has spoken in the mental disease or defect, and it doesn't fit for this kind of condition, and so therefore you as a judge cannot use it as a non-statutory mitigating factor, and I was required to impose the presumptive term. The good news was that the Department of Corrections internally...
Yeah, if you could just identify yourself just for our...
...the defendant in a positive way.
If you could just identify yourself for the record, that'd be useful. I know it's you, Judge Jeffrey, but just go ahead. and identify yourself.
As far as I know, it is, the current law is not adequate to deal with this, and that's why this proposed legislation is so important and is very, very meaningful. As far as the question about who does the diagnosing, Vicki Tinker is part of a diagnostic team in Kenai and could answer that really well, but my reaction to the quote as determined by a neuropsychological examination, I feel is too limited. It's quite correct that when there's a diagnostic team, a medical doctor does make the diagnosis based on the input from the other members of the team. But I believe, and Ms. Tinker can probably knows this better, but I believe it is a doctor, and it does not require that they have the specialty of being able to give neuropsychological examinations. They just have to be a medical doctor. And so having that particular language in there would be a big limitation. A lot of people who even have a professional FASD diagnosis wouldn't fit within that definition, so I've got a question mark on that one. But I, you know, just in general, this is smart justice. This is what this is all about. It's instead of absolutely having to use the minimum presumptive terms that are laid out in the statutes for these different crimes, at least this opens the door to some flexibility by a judicial officer to say that this particular person, remember, they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that they have the condition and that significantly affected their conduct. And that is that's a tough burden. But if they can make those showing, then it opens the door to the possibility that a judge would be able to adjust the presumptive term downward and have more work with the defendant out in the community rather than taking up a hard jail cell at great expense to the state and taking it away from perhaps a much more violent person. I am pleased that the current version that you're looking at eliminates the prohibition on it being applicable to anyone with an assaulted offense. I think that was a good idea to provide the more flexibility. And so those would be my comments, and I just so much appreciate the time the committee's taking and the dedication that's gone into considering this.
Thank you. Good statement. And just for as a formality, please identify yourself for the record. We know who's speaking, but we just...
Gee, I should know that. Yes, this is Michael Jeffrey. I live in Bear, Alaska. I'm testifying personally. I do not represent the Alaska court system, but I am the Superior Court Judge in Barrow since 1982.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Judge.
You.
Yeah, we appreciate it. We don't get to hear from judges enough, really, in committee, but I appreciate your making yourself available. It's actually interesting. And let me just ask, how prevalent is FASD, in your view, amongst the defendants who appear before you in court?
That's a great question and a difficult one, because one of the things that this particular disability is so difficult, and this is absolute scientific studies that are showing this, that the difficulty is that someone can appear completely normal and they can talk just like someone of their age, and they can tell you they understand things. And yet, when they're, affected in a certain more severe way, they actually are understanding at about half their chronological age. So you may have a young adult in there that appears to be, the understanding this and that, and actually their mind is way back in middle school somewhere. And so it's very, you can't tell, it's not like the other disabilities where there's the kind of obvious, and it's not necessarily obvious here. And the other thing is, for we rural folk, there are very few actual diagnoses available. And, the hope would be that they'll become more so. And one of the ideas that's being worked on within the Department of Health and Social Services is the idea of traveling diagnostic teams that would would get these professional diagnoses out to the rural areas. So on the one hand, it's very unusual that I have a defendant in front of me in criminal cases who's actually been diagnosed. Usually it happens because they were in the child welfare system or the juvenile justice system and got a diagnosis when they were younger. Sometimes it happens outside that, but usually that's the scenario. And yet I also feel that a significant percentage, and it's a guess, that a very significant percentage of the people appearing in front of me on felonies and even juvenile delinquency in these other cases are affected to some degree. And the only way I've figured it out is to try to adapt kind of on the assumption that most everybody is. So I say more during the hearings, I slow it down, I have concrete language in my forms and so on, because I just can't really tell for sure, and you certainly can't diagnose from the bench, that's for sure. So it's a very difficult question.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. And Senator Coghill has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Judge, for testifying. One of the questions that comes to mind is the application of this. So I understand they might fall under a presumptive sentence, but they also might be a danger to themselves or others on this. What do you suppose would be a way to handle this once a mitigator came to be?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last part of what you said.
Mr. Chairman, what I'm looking for, Judge, is how the mitigator is applied and what accountability measures might also be applied should somebody still be perceived to be a danger, even though mentally they may have issues processing. How do we hold somebody accountable in a case like this?
You bet. Well, again, as Senator Meyer said at the beginning, this is not an automatic reduction of a sentence. It only opens the door. And, for example, and I'm speaking of cases as recently as this last weekend when I was doing weekend arraignments, I mean, there are people in front of me that I'm very convinced are affected, but they are dangerous people. And they are in jail, I mean, you know. and you know, that's the reality. We need to protect the community. And so even if they could make the showing, it doesn't necessarily mean that the sentence would be adjusted. In fact, if there's aggravating factors, it could go the other direction. But there are, you know, there are these various folks that, where it would be very meaningful and save the state money and be much more effective in working with them to have them out of a jail sooner, not completely, but sooner than they would be otherwise. And accountability, you know, remains the criminal justice system. In other words, if they're out and they're being treated and so on, and then they commit another offense, then of course they're back in, and then the lesson is that the kind of supports available in the community aren't enough for this person, and there's a very good argument that they should do, you know, the full presumptive term.
Further questions for the judge? We don't see any here, but again, we really appreciate hearing from you, particularly given your vantage point in the system. And so thank you very much for making time to give us your perspective today on this important bill.
Okay, and I'll be listening in for the rest of the consideration if anything else comes up. But so much appreciate the committee's consideration. Thank you.
Very good. Let's turn to Vicki Tinker in Kenai with the Kenai FASD. I don't know if it's an organization or a task force, but Ms. Tinker, if you're there, go ahead and put yourself on the record. Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Okay, my name is Vicki Tinker, and I coordinate the FASD diagnostic program on the Kenai Peninsula.
And you heard my question earlier about diagnosing this under the terms of the bill. Maybe you can just give us your perspective on what it will take to put this evidence in front of a court.
Technically, fetal alcohol syndrome can be diagnosed by any physician, but the way it's done in Alaska, there are diagnostic teams all around the state in Alaska, and it's a system that was designed by the University of Washington, and it involves a physician, a psychologist, a speech therapist, and sometimes an occupational therapist that all give their input on an individual's diagnosis. The final say on it is the physician. And there are some teams who have neuropsychologists And there are some teams who just have psychologists without that neurospecialty in it. And so that wording is problematic because a neuropsychologist by themselves cannot diagnose FASD, but they are certainly a big part of the picture.
I appreciate that clarification, and we certainly don't want to create a problem where there isn't one. It sounds to me like a physician is the sort of essential component of the diagnosis, and they would be conducting a psychological exam. You're just concerned about adding the word neuro. It may restrict the ability of some physicians to make the diagnosis. Is that right?
Correct. And by the team design, the medical provider on the team actually can be a mid-level practitioner, such as a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. But that it would be unusual for a mid-level practitioner to make that official diagnosis on their own.
Okay, and I might have missed the first half of that sentence, so I guess I'm just wanting to make sure. I mean, in my view, having a physician make the diagnosis is appropriate. I wouldn't want I wouldn't personally want it, you know, just my own comfort level. Other committee members may feel differently, but my own personal comfort level would be not so warm to the idea of a physician's assistant or even a licensed nurse practitioner. All very confident people, but this is a serious diagnosis.
Yes, and in the state of Alaska, where we use the University of Washington diagnostic model, when a physician or a nurse practitioner is making that final diagnosis, it's using the information by these other providers, such as the neuropsychologist and the speech pathologist. They're not making it independently.
Sure.
But it is a medical diagnosis.
Sure. Well, we'll work with that language. We'll work with the bill sponsor and see if we can come up with Senator Coghill.
Just maybe a point of clarification. You said there were five different teams throughout Alaska?
I think that there are eight or nine right now.
Okay. And would they be easily drawn upon by the court, or is that a ad hoc group? How do we look at those?
They would be easily drawn upon by the court.
Okay.
There are some communities of great need that don't have diagnostic teams, but teams from other areas can, you know, the individuals, like say there are individuals that come down to the Kenai Peninsula to our diagnostic team here that don't have services in their own area.
Thank you.
Senator Pasquin has a question.
As I understand, you're concerned that the use of the term neuropsychological may be too narrow. What would your recommendation be as far as the definition of the examination?
A neuropsychologist does not make the diagnosis. A medical provider does.
So
I think you would be safe to say a physician or a diagnostic team.
And if we just said as determined by a physician, would that encompass the diagnostic team, or would that be too narrow for the teams?
It would be too narrow. There is. Currently a diagnostic team in Anchorage through Assets that's a very high quality, has a lot of very top-notch people on it, and their medical provider at this time is an advanced nurse practitioner who has probably more knowledge of the disability than most physicians do.
Is there a definition in law for what a diagnostic team is, or would we have to be creating one?
I don't believe it's, no, I think by law it's a medical provider that makes the diagnosis, but in Alaska we do have these teams at our disposal for diagnosis, and it is the gold standard for diagnosis.
Okay, we'll just have to churn on that a little bit. Further questions? Senator Pasquin, go ahead.
Yeah. Do we have the information in our packet on this University of Washington model that we are apparently following? I think that would be something that would be important, because I would suspect in there that this issue of the diagnostic team or the physician's participation in that process is probably set forth in that model.
That may be a getting a signal from the back. Further questions for Ms. Tinker? We may have people in the room who can tell us more about this.
Just one.
Senator Cochran.
More. Thank you. And Ms. Tinker, you know, one of the questions that will probably arise along the way is, will somebody go to the a diagnostic team for a defense when there may not be a legitimate defense? And I think that's one of the reasons why credentialing is so important. So help us understand a diagnostic spectrum a little bit from, say, low-functioning to high-functioning. Can you help us understand that a little bit?
Sure. You mean, like, what does disability look like along the spectrum?
Sure, because what I'm thinking is probably the court will ask, what is the ability to respond accountably? And I'd like to know, as we look into this, is there a range that we should be thinking of when we go into this?
I'm not sure what you mean by accountability. Who being accountable to whom?
Well, it looks like that according to the FASD and the brain, there are some that just can't make a right decision, and there are some that can. And it would be interesting to us to know, you know, is there a range that that we can say this is definitely true or not?
Yeah, that's a good question and a complicated one. Because the disorder happens along a spectrum, you know, on the lighter end, there may not be a whole lot of damage and someone can function in society and not break rules and fit well within our cultural norms. And on the far end of the spectrum, may have so little control over their behavior and their decision making that they need to be institutionalized. And there's everything in the middle. And there can be somebody kind of on the lighter end of the spectrum who has a fairly high IQ and does well in school, but perhaps their ability to make decisions in everyday life is pretty impaired. And that's where they would get into legal trouble. So even if somebody is down on the lower end of the spectrum, it may affect their ability to make good decisions. It may affect their ability to control their impulses, to connect consequences to their actions. So it's not so straightforward as saying everybody from this part of the spectrum on down would be eligible for this, and those on the other side should be able to get their act together.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, I'm only asking the question because I know that the judge gets to make the decision eventually. We're going to try to figure out what does the judge get to make the decision on. And if it's a diagnostic by a nurse practitioner, then it looks like some will be very well informed and others may not be so well informed. So I'm just trying to think how do I look into that. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's good questions all. We do have some people here in the room who want to testify, and I'd like to turn to that unless there's more questions for Ms. Tinker.
They're saying this guy with the beard.
Yeah. Ms. Tinker, thanks so much for being here.
Certainly.
Kate Burkhart is here from the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug. Ms. Burkhart, welcome. Put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Kate Burkhart, and I'm the Executive Director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse, as well as the Alaska Mental Health Board. My comments today are on behalf of those organizations and no one else. We are a member of the Alaska FASD Partnership, a community coalition of about 70 organizations and individuals, and we provide staff coordination to that organization. As you've heard from people speaking before me, you'll hear us refer to Smart Justice and how excited we were by Justice Carpinetti's comments, because this specific population, Alaskans experiencing fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, are disproportionately represented in our corrections population as well as in our justice system. And so SB 151, in all of its iterations, including the one before you, is an opportunity to embrace that call to make criminal justice decisions that look first to alternative sentences and punishments that both protect the public and rehabilitate the perpetrator, reserving the most costly option, prison, for those situations where there are not more effective alternatives. And I want to reiterate the comments of Judge Jeffrey and his explanation of the situation where he had before him someone that he thought experienced a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, but an alternative sentence in the community was not an option. And so that person's in jail. And that reinforces the discretion that SB 151 affords judges. And we really want to emphasize that following up on Senator Coghill's questions, the diagnosis is not enough. It has to show that the person was substantially impaired and was unable to have the requisite cognition to fully comprehend their behavior. And so, and there is a balancing of public safety and whether or not a community option is a good option for both the public and the perpetrator. SB 151 is a move to evidence-based sentencing, and in order to make that move, judges do require flexibility, and we support the effort to give judges the option to look to either lesser sentences or community custodial situations with electronic monitoring that are also attached to community-based services and supports to help that person find a way to function successfully in the community. Regarding the CS before you, I want to echo the concerns about the neuropsychological examination limitation. The diagnostic teams in Alaska are all credentialed by the University of Washington, so we don't have just assortments of well-meaning people deciding to do this. You've heard from Vicki Tinker, who is a well-respected professional in this field. I think you'll probably hear from Rick Iallolino, who works with the Juno, or who has worked with the Juno diagnostic team. They're all credentialed by the University of Washington and work closely with the Department of Health and Social Services. I do think that language such as a physician or a University of Washington credentialed FASD diagnostic team would probably address the concerns of the committee members as to the level of experience and expertise of the person making the diagnosis and would reflect the actualities in Alaska of what our teams do. I'd also reference the language in the CS in AS 1255-155-D18, which is at lines 12 and following on page 3 of the CS. One of the things that it had been, I think, the entire group of stakeholders working on this bill's hope was that we could provide an opportunity to stop the cycle of recidivism early. Folks that experience fetal alcohol spectrum disorders often are repeat offenders, and that's not limited to misdemeanors. And so right now, the language in the CS in 18 does not allow for the use of a mitigator when there is a crime against the person. And so in an area where this particular population is often a repeat offender, we don't have the ability to stop that cycle with the way the CS is written. I have seen some language that would say that except for repeat felonies, that the mitigator could be applied in crimes against the person. And I think that that's a balance. We don't want repeat assaultive people potentially in our communities. But if it's a first-time assault, felony assault, and there's a clear diagnosis of a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, that's our opportunity to be smart, and that's our opportunity to be flexible and potentially break that cycle of recidivism. So I would suggest that the committee take another look at Section 18 and see if you can do that balancing, because I think that that's an opportunity to really affect smart justice. And so I'd just like to thank the sponsor and all the people that have been involved. We've been working on this a long time. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Questions from Ms. Burkhart? I don't see any. Let's turn to Rick. And I'm sorry, the way you wrote your name, I can't read it, so I'm sorry. Welcome to the committee.
I'm Rick Iannino. It's spelled I-A-N-N-O-L-I-N-O. I coordinate the Juneau FASD Diagnostic Clinic, and I've done it for 8 years. I think I can explain some of the questions that you have about the composition of the diagnostic team and the responsibilities of each member of the team. The physician, after, you know, FASD is primarily looked at as a brain dysfunction. A doctor really doesn't substantially look at the brain dysfunction portion of the diagnosis. They'll do a they'll look for microcephaly, which means a small skull, so they'll measure the skull size. They'll look at pedal fissures, which are the openings in the eyes, to see if they're smaller than most children's. That's part of the syndrome, the actual physical syndrome of FAS, but not of FASD. They'll look at the philtrum, which is a groove under our nose, to see if it's smooth or sometimes invisible in more severe cases. And they'll look at the vermilion color, or sometimes absence of color, of the thin upper lip of people affected. They'll look at dysmorphology, such as ears, stubbed nose, small chin, toes, fingers, malformed. They'll look at those things. They're physically. They look at the physical aspects. So for many years, a physician assistant was the medical person in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta for many, many years. And they ran a good clinic. And as you know, the Assets Clinic in Anchorage also has a medical person that's a non-physician. So there shouldn't be any conflict, in my opinion, with that, after all these years of having the clinics run and doing a good job. With the issue of the neuropsych exam, we refer to a neuropsych because neuropsychological examinations are extremely valuable, but they're not required members of the team under the University of Washington's four-digit diagnostic team certification. We refer to neuropsychs. They'll take 6 or 8 hours sometimes to do the assessment. At the clinics, we usually have a psychologist, can be a school psychologist or a clinical psychologist, PhD psychologist. We have, and what they'll do is look at the actual functioning of the brain, the processing time, the executive functioning, the ability to plan, the ability to understand abstract concepts such as time, the ability to, whether they can, they'll look at the scores such as, you know, their reading scores. They'll look at verbal and nonverbal. They'll look at something called the Vineland test, which sees how they work actually, their functional abilities in real life, their actual functional abilities. So there's an extensive amount of brain assessments that the psychological, certainly more than doctors do. Then there's a speech and language pathologist. They'll look at receptive communication, which is a communication that comes through our ears, and then our brain processes this information that comes in. It's not only through our ears, it can be any kind of sense, touch, taste, sight, hearing, so on. And then the assessment assesses what do they do with this information, how fast do they process, but can they understand sentences, can they understand words coming in, and what do they do with that information, how can they use it, how do they understand it. That's what the speech and language part of what they do. We also have occupational and physical therapists. Those two professions overlap, by the way. The occupational looks at the everyday activities that you use with your hands, sort of finer muscles of things that you do. The physical therapist looks at the larger muscles and the limbs and how they move, because the brain affects everything in the body, of course. So we'll look at that. And part of that is sensory integration. People with FASD many, many times, very commonly and severely, have something called sensory integration. What that means is that things like lights, these lights might be 10 times as bright for a person whose brain does not allow them to filter the light out like our brains do. We're actually able to filter. They can't. And the same thing with touch. Their clothes sometimes are painful. Touching is painful sometimes, especially light touch in many cases. They can be hypo or hyper, which means they sometimes hypo meaning less, they have less sensitivity, which means they can be burned and cut and they don't know it sometimes. The other half, or feel cold.
Maybe you can just tell me a few, just tell me a little bit more about the diagnostic team. Who
who's on the team, how many members are there, how long does it
take? Okay, I can tell you for our team, because each team is different, but the requirements under the state FASD Providers Agreement require that we have a doctor, that we have a psychologist, an OT, and then one of the multiple choice, a physical therapist, occupational therapist, or a speech and language pathologist, and a parent navigator. Now, parent navigators
are
critical.
And are you a member of the team?
I am the coordinator of the team, and I've been so for 8 years.
And so you don't participate in the actual rendering of the diagnosis?
I assist with a lot of resource material, and I coordinate making sure that the doctors and the professionals are appropriate for that particular client.
Sure, but you're not an
No, no.
I think I understand. Other questions? And how many of these cases does your team get per year?
Our particular team is all volunteer, by the way. All the doctors and everybody volunteer. I'm the only paid person. We see 24 a year. We've been in existence for 8 years, so you can do the math.
Okay.
We've seen quite a few people.
Two a month.
And
those are the questions I have. Other questions? Senator Cockin.
Yeah, I think one of the questions we're trying to figure out is how do we see a team? Because that's why I asked, is it ad hoc? And it looks like to me that in various different teams around the state, they are a little bit in that nature. One of the things that we have in the bill before us, not only the neuropsychological, but talks about permanent defects. So I understand at the high end that permanent is a little easier to get to. But is there a cognitive growth that happens with some FASD?
The damage is permanent. Whether we can accommodate and learn other ways of learning, that's possible, but the severe damage is permanent damage. One of the diagnoses called static encephalopathy. Static meaning it's not progressive. It was done in the fetus, and it doesn't progress, you know, from there. And enceph means brain, and pathology, of course, means a disorder. That's one. We have 256 specific diagnoses, by the way, and they're divided into sections. The person who's a little less damaged, and that means brain damage. Basically, static encephalopathy literally means brain damaged. The next is neural behavioral disorders. Those are where there's definitely functions of the brain that have been impaired, but they're not as severe as a brain damage as in static encephalopathy.
Senator Passman has a question.
You know, I'm interested in the University of Washington credentialing and how you go through that process and, you know, what if a certain volunteer withdraws from this diagnostic team, what happens to the credentialing?
Now, most teams are actually funded through either IHS funds or if they have they can do Medicaid, you know, billing, such as Vicki Tinkers is covered by Medicaid substantially. Ours is not because I'm testifying here as a personally. I'm taking leave to be here, even though I coordinate the clinic. I'm not representing the tribes, but. The tribe cannot bill, so that's why Juno has a team, because we have a tremendous community support for this, and we understand the tremendous need, long waiting lists and all that we've had. And I've seen many adults, by the way. I'm the person who navigates and is the advocate for people with FASD who are adults. That's part of my position. So I can ask any of those questions you may wish.
Other questions?
I guess Senator Pascal, getting to the point of this
certification.
Bill,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, to the certification or the credentialing, but ultimately, how many people do you believe would qualify to present this as a mitigator at a criminal proceeding? You know, just your gut feel as far as, in other words, what are we talking about here?
You know, when we see people at the clinic, most of our people come in because they're having severe problems. The people who are less affected many times are functioning, and we all have differences and we all have problems as human beings. So they just think they were born that way, so they don't see any problem. People who are really having problems with the law or school or acting out, emotionally not able to be stable and function in daily lives with their families, with their children, or as adults, keep employment or you know, relationships and so on, or rent. Or they're homeless many times.
Do you, let me just maybe focus the question a little bit.
Yeah.
Do you get many people who have pending criminal cases against them into
yes.
your clinic?
Okay. Yes. Okay. Many.
And are they seeking a diagnosis for court purposes, or because they're just having, because a variety of issues have driven them towards you?
They're trying to live.
Sure.
They're trying to live. That's what they're trying to do. And inadvertently, some of the most innocent people you ever see, fairly low functioning in terms of their ability to live in this world, are put in and out of jail. They don't know what they're answering. They have no idea what the legal system is. They'll agree with you because they want to be friendly and nice to people, and they end up in jail for many, many years, and then they come out and they'll, you know, they're lonely and they might take a drink, some, and they go two more years. I've had a person that went to jail for six consecutive years. He took a drink, and every time he went for two more years, and he's now successful with a lot of support. He has a business, and he's successful. So, I mean, there are a lot of successes.
Sure, I don't mean to be cut you off.
Yeah,
but
I understand.
We're under time pressure, and there's a sort of a focused question, and there's the. I don't mean to be. We're under time pressure ourselves.
Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Further questions? Thank you so much. Is here as well. Ms. Rolick? Welcome to the committee.
My name is Margaret Froelich, and I'm a parent of an adult who has been diagnosed with our local team with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and I was a parent navigator on our local team as kind of my way of paying back for what they did for us. I'm reading the bill, the version T I had no problem with, but with this particular bill, The number 18, I could see that.
Just ma'am, the one I have has an O.
Is the O? I've got
O.
The
O. Very good. Okay.
Thank you
Okay.
Double checking on that.
That's okay. And you're on page
on three
sub 18. Yep. Go ahead.
On the subsection 18, it would be very easy for somebody with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder to become a felon, and that's the way our present laws are written, and so this, with that number 18 in there, wouldn't make any difference for this particular population. It would still end up in the recycling just because their first offense was a felon. They could be driving a friend who's delivering cocaine to somebody else, and they get picked up with their friend, and they're in there. They're a felon. So they weren't much of a, they didn't see that they were doing anything wrong, but they committed a felony offense.
It happens, unfortunately.
It does.
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, that was basically what I wanted to say. My son was diagnosed when he was in his 20s, and that was a tremendous boon for us, for him and for me. I'm the one who kind of navigates him in life, so to speak. It was a team, but I had confidence in the team because of knowing the professional background of each team member and of seeing how the team operated together to make this diagnosis. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We all have Annie Carpinetti here from the Department of Law, but I think I'm going to hold off on her. We've gotten a good overview of the bill, and I've schedule another bill for today, SB 180, that I'd like to at least get introduced in front of the committee. So the committee's got some things to chew on with respect to this bill. I think it's a good idea. I appreciate Senator Meyer bringing it forward. We will take action on it soon. But for the time being, let's set that bill aside and bring up SB 180, naturally occurring asbestos in gravel. And we have a staff member of the sponsoring senator. Welcome to the committee. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us your opening statement.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is David Scott. I'm staff to Senator Olson. Senator Olson sends his regards. He's going to be here today. There's lots of scheduling issues going on. The bill before is that I'm working off is version D. I hope that all.
And let's
got
just
it.
Make sure backslash D. Yep, that's the one we have.
It's a blank CSD, by the way, Mr. Chairman.
And let's go ahead and have a motion to adopt it.
So moved.
Any objection? Backslash D is before us. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could proceed however you choose.
Just tell us a
broad overview. The bill, I'll close this, I don't. The bill before the committee, Mr. Chairman, regulates the use of naturally occurring asbestos in gravel for predominantly transportation projects, roads, airports. Say there's building a school, they needed a pad, stuff like that. There are areas of Alaska where naturally occurring asbestos is very prevalent, from southeast to the interior to the northwest Arctic. There's an area on the upper Kobuk, an area that is represented by the sponsor, the Ambler area. I'm sure we've all heard of it, the Ambler mining area. And it's in the upper Kobuk Valley, and it's very prevalent there. And since NOA has been found in the gravel there, all construction has stopped. It's just stopped.
I did not know that.
There's been no. I have a list, provided a list to the committee on some delayed projects in the Ambler area. One is, I can name them really quickly. It's the airport extension.
Oh, I see now, yep.
Replacement of a Grizzly Bridge. If you guys have that, I won't go over.
School playground, future home sites. And when did the naturally occurring asbestos come to light there?
I would venture to guess it's been a decade. They've been done for a decade. So either early 2000s, late 1990s.
Construction projects have been on hold since then?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Wow. That is correct. Let's see. Within the bill, there's an immunity clause. It offers liability immunity to not only the state but contractors if they follow the standing operating procedures of the state, which is why it is here in this committee. For the committee's knowledge, there's a companion bill in the House. That bill did not get referred to the Judiciary Committee on that side. So the sponsor of this bill and the sponsor of the companion bill and the other body, they are very, I don't know if you want to say pleased or relieved to be in front of your committee, but they know the bill needs a good scrubbing when it comes to the immunity offered in the bill.
An immunity would be basically to hold anyone harmless for maybe deleterious health effects to being exposed to naturally occurring asbestos.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If they're granted the immunity, if they follow the procedures set up by...
Procedures, right, do everything right.
They do everything right, they're granted the immunity. If they do not do anything, if they do
something wrong...
Or if they decide to use gravel with NOAA in it without going through a certain... getting a plan approved by DOT, if they just decided to go forward, they would be held liable for any civil action that came forward.
And is naturally occurring asbestos, does it present the same health issues as the kind that we hear about in paint and in insulation?
Through the chair, Senator. All right, sorry, Mr. Chairman. It's a very good question, and I believe it could best be answered by either representatives from DEC, HESS, or even DOT. But in previous committees, it was a geologist who said that you could take asbestos, mix it in water, and drink it, and you're fine. It's the breathing in of the fibers, and there are different lengths of fibers in asbestos. I think there's, if memory serves, there's seven different types of asbestos, ranging from very small little fibers to long fibers. And there's also there's a definition in the bill of naturally occurring asbestos, which means it has not been milled. It has not been, there's no value added to it. That digging it out of the ground is not a value, it's not milled. It's not.
And does naturally occurring asbestos occur in gravel outside of the Ambler region?
Mr. Chairman, it does. There are places in southeast here. I believe right here in Juneau, there's a quarry that does contain naturally occurring asbestos. It's prevalent among where you find jade. Some reason, I'm not a geologist. I can't explain why. But in the upper Kobuk region, there's a jade mountain, and I believe there's also an asbestos mountain.
Okay. We do have representatives from DOT, from ADEC, from NANA, and we have a physician on the line to answer questions. Maybe let's turn to Joe McLaughlin, the physician. Unless there's further questions, are there any questions for Mr. Scott? Thank you so much for being here. And at least get the medical questions on the record before we have to adjourn and go to the floor. Dr. McLaughlin, are you there?
Hi, Mr. Chairperson. Yes, this is Dr. Joe McLaughlin, and I am the state epidemiologist with the Department of Health and Social Services.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I could just start, if it'd be okay with you, by just saying what the concern is with asbestos.
Sure.
So, in brief, all forms of asbestos are hazardous to humans, and all can cause lung cancer, mesothelioma, and non-malignant lung conditions such as asbestosis. There really is no health threat if naturally occurring asbestos remains undisturbed and doesn't become airborne. But if natural weathering happens or there's human disturbance that can break the NOAA down into microscopic fibers that can readily become suspended in air for long periods of time and inhaled, that's where the concern arises. And in general, longer, thinner fibers are considered to be more toxic because they can reach the lower areas of the lung, the alveoli, and become lodged in that area, and then they cause an inflammation reaction that can lead to some of these severe outcomes. So in general, all asbestos fibers are concerning. Now, the good news with Ambler in particular is that the type of asbestos that's found there is considered to be the least toxic of the six major asbestos fibers. But that doesn't mean that they're non-toxic. And so I guess I'll leave it at that and see if there are other questions.
Yeah, I have a couple, but Senator Pascrin has one. Go ahead.
Sure. You know, what I'm trying to understand here is, you know, certainly we are disturbing the gravel if you are harvesting it and then putting it on a roadway. And if it's not a paved roadway, then it would be continuously picked up and put into the air. Is that an issue?
Senator, through the chair, yes, that is a concern. Certainly, from the human health standpoint, there is no safe threshold for airborne exposure to asbestos. So that's the big concern, and that's why this all these projects have languished for so long up in Ambler, because that is a health concern.
And Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Sure. Doctor, are there any safe levels of asbestos exposure that a person can be exposed to?
Senator, through the chair, there is no safe threshold for airborne exposure to asbestos. So even one exposure to one asbestos fiber that gets lodged into somebody's alveolar tissue could potentially lead to health consequences, and that's the concern that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have raised, US EPA has raised, and certainly all health departments in the country. And so to answer your question, there is no safe threshold for airborne exposure to asbestos from a human health standpoint.
So, Wilkowski,
is there what's the typical latency period for getting asbestosis or mesothelioma or COPD or something asbestos related?
Senator, through the chair, most asbestos-related diseases occur at least 10 to 40 years after the first exposure.
And I'm just trying to figure out how this bill works. So we're giving immunity to persons supplying or using the gravel. So if we allow this gravel to be used and put on a road surface, then cars go over it, they're potentially churning it up. It gets into the air. I mean, is there, do you see a risk there?
Senator, through the chair, there's always a risk when you're dealing with naturally occurring asbestos in air. My understanding of the intention of this bill is to do a couple of things. One is to set a threshold for an analytic threshold for detection of naturally occurring asbestos in gravel. And as I understand it, the bill was very closely modeled after the California law, which has been in effect for some time. And the California law sets a threshold at 0.25% naturally occurring asbestos in gravel. And so what the California law says is that if there's less than 0.25% naturally occurring asbestos in gravel, their Department of Transportation can use that gravel for surfacing roads. And that's actually an analytical detection limit, and I'll try and explain that real briefly. What the laboratories in California are required to do when analyzing surface substrate, gravel that's going to be used for surfacing roads, is they have to take representative samples of that gravel, and then they look at samples of that gravel under the microscope, and they're actually required to do 400-point observations under the microscope. If they find one asbestos fiber in one of those point observations, 1 divided by 400 is 0.0025. If you multiply that by 100%, you get a 0.25% of naturally occurring asbestos in that substrate. And so what they've said is that if you find one fiber, you hit that limit, that analytical detection limit of 0.25%, and you can't use the gravel for surfacing. If you don't find any fibers, you can't say that there's no asbestos in the gravel, but all you can say is that it was below the analytical threshold level. And so that's the California law.
And what percentage do you know about the annular gravel? What percentage of naturally occurring asbestos is in the gravel when it comes out of the ground?
Senator, through the chair, there have been a number of studies that have been done. The concentration of naturally occurring asbestos ranges, and it depends on the site that has been tested, anywhere from greater than or equal to 10% to less than 1%. So it really just depends on the sites that have been tested. And the Department of Transportation may have more recent data because I know they've been doing some testing, and they may be able to add to this.
And let me just ask a question then, Senator Paskin. If the gravel's coming out of the ground at 10%, is there any way to mill the asbestos out? I mean, you'll just have to forgive me. That's a stupid question, but I just don't know how else to ask it. Can you reduce the amount of asbestos in the gravel after it comes out of the ground, or are you stuck with that level as being what the gravel's going to be? Or do you know?
Senator, through the chair, was that directed to me?
Yes. Yeah. If you know.
Senator, through the chair, I'm not sure. I would defer to our specialist at DOT to see if they have an answer to that.
That's fine. Senator Paskin has a question.
Sure. My question focuses on the California standard. When I look at the roads in California, most of them are paved. And so if that's incorporated into, the asbestos issue, is there a difference if you don't put pavement down, it's just a gravel road, as compared to gravel that's involved in a paving process? In other words, it seems like it's locked in if it's in a pavement.
Doctor, do you know if the California standard presupposes the usage of the gravel in pavement, or is it usage for all purposes?
Mr. Chairperson, the answer to that is there are circumstances under which naturally occurring asbestos-containing gravel may be used for surfacing roads that are not actually paved. And I would turn your all's attention to the asbestos ATCM for surfacing applications, and I can send that your way, and that provides provisions for surfacing applications in remote locations, for example, where no alternative aggregate materials are reasonably available. The California law actually allows exemptions, and this particular one I'm citing is a 3-year exemption that I believe is renewable. So I can go ahead and send that to you all.
If you would, Senator Wilkowski has a question, then we're going to have to break.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, two questions. Question one is, what are the federal limits on using asbestos? Do they have a similar type of 0.25% limit, or is it? Can you talk about that? And number two would be the workers who would be working on these sites, what sort of safety gear would they need safety gear? What type of safety equipment, gear, respirators would you suggest they wear, or are they required to wear?
Thank you for that question, Senator. Through the chair, First of all, with respect to human health, nationally, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and U.S. EPA have not established a safe threshold level for exposure to naturally occurring asbestos. So it's a zero threshold toxin from the human health standpoint. Now, that said, the federal government has made asbestos regulations to protect human health. In 1989, EPA banned all new uses of asbestos, and uses established before this date are still allowed, however. EPA established regulations that require school systems to inspect for damaged asbestos and to eliminate or reduce the exposure by removing or covering or capping the asbestos. EPA regulates the release of asbestos from factories and during building demolition or renovation to prevent asbestos from getting into the environment. And EPA has also proposed a limit of 7 million fibers per liter of drinking water for long fibers. And then the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, has set a limit of 100,000 fibers greater than or equal to 5 microns per cubic meter of work place air for 8-hour shifts and 40-hour work weeks. Now, there are specific guidelines that a workplace has to follow when there is asbestos in air, you know, in the air that the workers are working under, and so those guidelines do exist.
Doctor, thank you very much for making yourself available to the committee. Your testimony has been very helpful.
Mr. Chairperson, it's always a pleasure.
We are going to have to set this bill aside, given that we're doing the floor here in a few minutes. This is a very interesting bill. I'm sure we will be turning and looking to the Department of Environmental Conservation for more information, as well as to the Department of Transportation, both of which had witnesses available to us today, but we're not going to be able to take use of your expertise right at the moment. So thank you all so much for being here. We're going to go ahead now and adjourn.